Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia, where it's a beautiful sunny day, first Monday of summer. And today on Military Monday, we're going to talk about one of the more interesting and obscure topics going around Washington today. No, I'm not talking about Supreme Court decisions or sequestration or immigration reform. We're going to talk about no-fly zones. Now, you may say, no-fly what? And therein lies why the show today is worth doing. A no-fly zone is essentially a decision by a country or a group of countries, a coalition, if you will, to deny the use of airspace to a country that is seen as doing bad things, usually to their own people, usually in the form of using their own air force and air power to inflict heavy casualties or to oppress them, even commit genocide in the case of some countries. And so the Allied coalition then goes and essentially announces a no-fly zone. Sorry about that. And establishes the no-fly zone, and not only goes and says your Air Force can't fly here, but also that you can't use the air for anything. You can't fly transport aircraft. You can't even use artillery and other types of weapons against the other side. Now, this obviously is something of a complex topic, and air power is always kind of a complex topic, and today we have gone and brought in one of the foremost experts on air power that we know in the area. His name is Colonel Walt Boyne. He's a retired U.S. Air Force colonel of many years' service, actively flew bombers for much of his career, up to and including, I believe, the B-52, and is a prolific writer on matters of air power. He has, in fact, written the air power equivalent of Alfred Thayer Mahan's famous book, and his is called The Influence of Air Power Upon History. Walt, are you there, sir?
Yes, John. How are you today?
Very good, sir. And kind of fill in that resume. What caused you to want to become a flyer in the first place? What drew you to flying and eventually air power as a profession?
Well, you know how ducklings are reportedly fixated on their mother at an introduction, that they just become, you know, instantly attracted to their mother. I had the same experience when I was 4 years old with a Pulp magazine. One of my brother's friends brought over one of those old Sky Devils or something, and on the cover was this beautiful World War One dogfight going on. I was 4 years old. I looked at it, decided I was going to be a pilot, and never varied after that.
So it really was a boyhood desire of yours to fly.
Unremitting. Just, you know, it was really... today they'd consider me Asperger's or something for being so fixated on it. But
Well, it certainly wasn't a crime in your time, and let's talk about that. When did you come into the U.S. Air Force?
Well, I entered in May 21st, 1951, and in those days they had a wonderful thing called the Aviation Cadet Program, and all you needed was 2 years of college. There were a lot of applications because the Korean War was on, of course, and you had to, one of the requirements is you entered and you went through basic training as a basic airman and then went and became a pre-cadet at a base and then became a cadet. And I always say that was great training. I think every officer, even academy types, should go through military basic training, and that you get an insight into the enlisted man and the non-commissioned man's ranks that you don't otherwise have. But then I got to go to flying school and was fortunate enough to be able to choose where I wanted to go, which at that time was SAC, and got to fly with SAC and B-47s and B-52s, or B-47s, rather. Went on then to... They sent me to school, and I went back to AFSC and got flew B-47s and B-52s with the 4925th Nuclear Test Group at Kirtland. So it was for me, it was every day was a pleasure.
So you got to fly the heavy iron of the Air Force back in those days.
Right, yes. Everybody, you know, has a desire to fly fighters. I certainly had it. But in those days, the convention was if you want to stay in the Air Force, you should go to fighters. If you're thinking about an airline career flight, go to bombers. And at the time, the whole group that I was going in with had the intention of becoming airline pilots, and most of my buddies did. But I don't regret it. I'd probably kill myself in fighters, so I was glad to survive the bombers.
And you got to fly some very interesting aircraft. I mean, for most people today, you know, obviously we still have B-52s with us, as we will probably after you and I are both dead and gone. But the B-47 was something of a hot rod back when you were flying it, was it not?
Yeah, it was absolutely magnificent. I went from B-50s to B-47s, and it was like going from a truck to a sports car. It was just amazing. We climbed faster than the B-50 would cruise, you know, and it was a delightful airplane to fly, even though it was a deadly airplane, John, though. At the time I was flying it, in the years before and after that, it was routine to lose two bombers a month, two B-47s a month, and usually lose the crews with them. They usually take off for landing accidents. We lost in 57 to 58, we lost 48 airplanes that it's unbelievable, unacceptable standards by today, and should have been unacceptable then. But it was a quirky airplane to fly, and we were flying it at its maximum capacity, so that's the reason for it.
So you spent the bulk of your career in and around heavy bombers with the Strategic Air Command, SAC. When did you get out? How long did you stay in the Air Force?
Well, I was in for 23 years, and most of it, one of the things that happened to the Air Force, they not only had wonderful aviation cadets, they had a wonderful AFIT program, so I got a bachelor's degree, and then they sent me for a master's degree, and I was all set to go to get a doctorate degree when I went to Thailand to fly over there. But I got out after 23 years because when the fuel crisis came in 73 and slightly prior to that, they had begun reducing flying hours, and I was a colonel, and they paid your flight pay as a colonel, but you couldn't fly, and that took much of the luster of being in the Air Force away from me. I liked it. I didn't dislike the Air Force without flying, but it just didn't seem to be the same. I preferred to fly, but then I got out and sadly didn't do as much flying as I'd anticipated in civil life.
Still had that little four-year-old boy desire to get up in the sky, huh?
Yeah. It's once you have it, it's hard to get rid of. And right now, I'm sending my grandson through flying training out of Leesburg, so I'm doing it precariously now.
Excellent. Now you said you were in Thailand. Were you down at Utapau with the B-52 unit down there?
I was at Utapau, but not with B-52s. They sent me to Utapau as an instructor pilot in the C-47, which I was happy to go. I didn't know what our mission was going to be. It turned out to be just a utility mission, but I was lucky, John. I got the worst assignment conceivable when I arrived there. I got off the airplane and was taken into the CO's office, wing commander's office, and he says, "I want you to be command for 635th Services Squadron." I had no idea what the Services Squadron was, but I said, "Sure." And turned out that's the dogs and cats of the thing, you know, the mess halls, the clubs, the motor pools, the laundry, all the things. I had about 900 airmen, or about 400 airmen and 900 Thais working for me, and it was. Absolutely rewarding because it was in terrible shape, but there were good people there that you could get to do things. And within about a year, we turned it into a really nice setup, and so it made the flying was great. I got to fly about 40, 50 hours a month, and the ground duty was 7 days a week, of course, but it was great too. So I had a great time there. I would have preferred to have been a FAC, and I always regret that I didn't know enough. I wasn't smart enough to apply for the F-101 program. I became aware of it only after I got reassigned there. So, but all in all, I never had a day in the Air Force I didn't enjoy.
And then you come out, and somewhere along the way, you get the notion to write about it, to start writing about aviation history military aviation history, and eventually air power itself. Where did that come from?
Well, you're way too young to remember this, but when I in
give me a try here, sir.
I started writing I sold my first piece in 1962, and the reason I began writing was that there were not too many aviation magazines around, not like there are today, and certainly not of the quality that there are today, and they were pretty much recycling material. It had a few guys like Arch Whitehouse and Kehoe and others who wrote, and they wrote pretty much the same stuff all the time, and they completely omitted some of the lesser-known things about aviation history. And at that time, there was a magazine that's got a well-deserved bad reputation called Air Classics. But they were the only ones who were looking into history. So I started writing for Joe Mizrahi, was there then. And I wrote on topics that were not covered by other people, unknown designers, little-known airplanes, unknown events. And it just turned out that there was a huge market for it, and I wrote all that. Everything I wrote, I could sell. And then Joe was tired of Air Classics, and he broke off and founded Wings and Air Power, and I did a lot of writing with them. So that's essentially how I got started. But it branched out. I wrote for probably over my lifetime 30 or 40 different magazines, not flying magazines, all of them, but just on aviation subjects.
And what kind of count on books have you written?
I mentioned
the one, but how many total have you written over the years?
Well, normally I say 54, but there's there's a couple that are written and unpublished, and there's a couple that are I wrote essentially for other people and published under their names. But if you said 50, you'd have a good handle on it.
So in that regard, you're very much the kind of prolific writer that our good friend Norman Pollmar is about Sea Power. You are his air power analog, if you will, in a lot of ways.
Well, I wouldn't presume to say that. I've got the greatest possible admiration for Norman, and he does work at a level of skill and scientific exactitude that I don't do. He has a very broad view. He's not only technically correct, but very good view and a nice guy to boot. So I'm glad to be a friend of his, but I would not claim to be the corresponding figure.
Well, let's move on from there. Now, you've also done a lot of television. Someone's decided that you have an excellent TVQ, as we say in the documentary film business, and you've done a lot of on-air stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm always wince when I see myself on TV. Lots of lines and bags and warts and wrinkles. But the fact is that when the documentaries on aviation got started, I had somewhat of a reputation established, and so a lot of people called them in. So I got a lot of calls from not only the cable channels, but also I was doing a lot of work for the broadcast channels too. But then I was got involved in the establishment of Wingspan, the Air and Space Channel, with Phil Osborne, and we co-founded that company. And he was an amazing guy, quite a genius, and at the time, I don't want to take too much time on this, but at the time we were told that it took 3 years and $170 million a year to get a channel on the air. And we managed to get a channel on the air in 1 year and about $7 million. And it was, believe me, it was very ragtag and very skimpy, but it was a channel that was on the air. And it astounded Discovery. And to their Discovery's great credit, they were our biggest customer in terms of material that they bought from us, To their very great credit, just coming over and saying, we'll sue you, you can't operate, they came over and bought us, which in a very fair way. I'm always amazed and grateful to Discovery for their measured approach to it. I think they were just so stunned that we actually got on the air that they felt that they shouldn't be underhanded about it. But anyway,
you and I have both had very positive relationships with Discovery Communications, and I've found them to be very much the same way through a variety of different production firms.
Yeah, it's remarkable too in the with the turnover of people that they have. I mean, they have a lot of talented people that pass through there and go on elsewhere, but they manage to maintain a very stable and very, very friendly kind of organization. And I see John Hendricks has a book out now. I can hardly wait to get it because, you know, he's a great aviation backer too, besides being founder of Discovery. So I'm anxious to see what he has to say.
Indeed. And for our listeners, if you want to call in and talk to Walt or myself or both of us during the show, please call in. The number is area code 347-945-7246. Call on in, and we'll take your questions or comments if you'd like to. Okay, now, Walt, let's talk a little bit about why we said we were going to do this show today, which is the question of no-fly zones. And the reason we're asking about it is, obviously, there is the Syrian civil war. It's been going on for years. The body count's approaching six figures very, very rapidly. The world is essentially repudiated by the actions of the Assad regime. And the question is, how do you go and obtain a positive traction on events of a national civil war? Not an easy or necessarily positive thing to do, but people are asking the question, what can we do? And one idea that keeps coming up is the idea of establishing a no-fly zone over Syria, thus denying them the use of their own airspace by their air force and other parts of their military to attack the FSA rebels. Talk a little bit about no-fly zones, and, you know, from the perspective of someone who's taken the long view of air power, what is air power's ability to influence events on the ground and in the air?
Well, you know, it's you have to weasel out by saying, of course, it's all relative. You can go anywhere from the sort of superb effort that we did in the northern and southern no-fly zones in Iraq, where we really suppressed them, the Iraqi effort, for a decade with a tremendous cost. It cost us in flying hours, and fortunately it didn't cost us in any shoot-downs by the Iraqis. We had one tragedy, of course, but the truth is that a country like the United States, with the resources it has, can impose a no-fly zone, but it can't do it without a cost, and the political implications today are so great because we're told by Russia that they will regard it as, not a hostile action against Russia, but they will certainly veto it in the UN, so that we can't look for the sort of UN or NATO lash-up that we got in Libya. So it's a difficult task that can be done at great expense and not without risk. Any no-fly zone that you fly over enemy territory, you could, A, be shot at by the enemy, and you can certainly understand their point of view, or B, you can have an accident or an in-flight emergency and have to bail out, and then you've got the recovery efforts that's required. But if you want to have a no-fly zone with the resources of the United States, you simply move them to the area. Now, it comes at the worst possible times in terms of the effects of sequestration and the other demands upon our services. But it we could do it, and if the forces are harder to do, they will do it. I just wish that we were a little bit more forward-thinking, and if we decide to do it, that we move more rapidly, and there's a reason for that we can discuss in a moment.
Okay. Now, when we say no-fly, that's a bit of a dodge in the sense that no-fly zone isn't just to shoot down enemy aircraft, helicopters, and other things violating the no-fly zone. It really is a no-kill zone that if we see banned weaponry ranging from artillery to fighter and attack aircraft, helicopters attacking, hypothetically, rebels on the ground, that we can go ahead and either shoot them down or we can actually bomb the offending target on the ground if it's an artillery site or a multiple rocket launcher or something like that, correct?
Absolutely. And that would be if you were going to establish – well, let's just see what the choices are for a moment. You can establish a no-fly zone over an entire country, as we did in Iraq for a while, and just – shoot down anything that moves, but to do that, you have to go in, you take out the enemy air defenses, and you do all the things that are necessary to fly an effective combat mission. You have satellites, and you have the Joint Stars, and you have the AWACS, and have all the other equipment in the area, have the transports, the aircraft carriers, you have the submarines with the Tomahawks, and you suppress them with a vast amount of ammunition and literally, you know, fight a war with them. And then you can have an area that they're talking about now that just do part of Syria, do just the Jordanian border and establish a no-fly zone over a smaller area. And that's another possibility. And there are some advocates who say you don't need to do a no-fly zone at all. You simply target the Syrian runways and the Syrian control areas and control Syrian air defenses and take them out with missiles, Tomahawks, and so on. So there's a variety of things, and that's one of the things that has to be decided by our government, what it intends to do if it is indeed going to apply a no-fly zone. We can't just there's not a one suit fits all kind of a thing that goes about it.
In other words, this is not just a punitive airstrike or two. This is an actual air campaign in the classic sense of it'll have phases, it'll have specific tasks and goals at various points, and it could be, as in the case of Iraq and the Balkans, it can go ahead and be something very short, a matter of weeks, like Libya was, or it can be long, years, even a decade or more, as Iraq and the Balkans were.
Yeah, and you can see within that two different kinds. Within the Balkan War, for example, we had no-fly zones that were effective, but they were effective not in winning the war, not in having the war come out in the direct way we wanted. So we had to depart from a no-fly zone and go into active combat with deliberate force and use air power then in a way that most of us dinosaurs prefer to be seen to use, you know, use it effectively and with a great deal of kinetic energy. That's a term that I laugh about now. They talk about instead of bombing somebody, they use kinetic weapons. Well, bombs are kinetic weapons, I agree, and so are missiles. But we have gotten so politically correct that we shy away from using terms that sound warlike, which is, I think, psychologically a mistake, both for us and a mistake that the other side can misinterpret.
Indeed. I remember some years ago when I was interviewing him, Colonel John Warden, the author of the Air Campaign, told me at one point, every bomb is a political bomb, and it can be political whether it's a Mark 82 500-pounder with a laser kit on the front of it, or whether you're pouring 50,000 MREs out the back of a C-17. I mean, anything you dump up off of an airplane has a political effect one way or the other.
Exactly, and it can be interpreted by your enemy in any way they wish. So that's why halfway measures are so unsatisfactory. You leave the initiative to the enemy, both not only militarily but psychologically.
Now, thankfully, if a decision is made to implement such a zone, we've got really strong leaders and professionals, particularly within the Air Force, who know how to do this, who have been involved in these kinds of operations since, in some cases, the beginnings of their career. I mean, we both talk about Dave Deptula, who, as a lieutenant colonel, was one of the guys who laid out the air campaign and the Iraqi no-fly zone and finished up his career actually running the air campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq in 2001 and 2003. We've got strong people who know how to do this, correct?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the Air Force has been in continuous combat now for a couple of decades, and never in any history has a armed force of any nation been so continuously in combat. You know, taking nothing away from any other of these services, Army, Navy, or Marines, or anything, the fact of the matter is that an Army campaign goes on for a length of time and they're relieved, the Navy deploys and comes back. But the Air Force has been engaged continuously in combat, and at every level we have experienced people that can make the most out of what you have to call somewhat aging equipment. Our equipment is old now and hasn't been brought up to the standards it should have been by the passage of time and by normal evolution. But still, they're so expert in it that there's really no comparison around the world. The Israeli Air Force has a similar situation, and the RAF, of course, is a great Air Force. But no opposing Air Force that we might encounter would have anything even to compare to any of it.
And this puts a lot of stress on an Air Force. And let's make sure we all understand, when we say Air Force, we are talking about the guys who wear blue in the U.S. military, the United States Air Force. But Air Forces come in all shapes and sizes, and we have multiple Air Forces within the U.S. military, Naval Aviation, Marine Corps Aviation, and, of course, Army Aviation as well.
Exactly.
In some ways, even artillery and rockets are a form of air power as well. So we have a lot to throw at it, but at the same time, the U.S. Air Force has just had a lot of stress since the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, it's really the amount of flying time that has put on our airplanes is incredible, and the solution to it has been very intelligent updates so that they extend the flying life and get airplanes that were originally intended that maybe have a 6,000-hour total flying time life wind up with 15 or 20,000 hours. But the problem that you run into is that land defenses have been able to grow at a stronger and faster rate than the ability to penetrate them. We have more trouble now. We'd have more trouble facing an intact Syrian air defense system than we would have had perhaps in going into Hanoi. I say an intact system because my presumption is that the Syrian air defenses have lost a lot of their effectiveness as a result of the civil war. I don't know anything to that effect, but it just stands to reason that'd be the case.
Well, and we'll talk a little more about the specifics of the Syrian Integrated Air Defense System, or IADS, in a few minutes. So let's say, hypothetically, you want to go and do a no-fly zone, and you want to go ahead and put a blanket over the Assad regime, beginning, obviously, at Damascus, but moving out towards the forward edge of battle area where the FSA and the Syrian army are engaged. You talked about having to go ahead, and even before you start flying the patrols to support the rebels on the ground, you have to do something called SEAD, or Suppression of Enemy Air Defenses. Explain what that means as an air power professional to people who have never been in a planning cell and have never seen an air campaign other than watching it on CNN as Baghdad goes up in flames.
Well, in explaining the suppression of enemy air defenses, you have to go back to a great general that was, you're either crazy about him or you hated him, Bill Creech.
Uncle Bill.
He was furious that the situation in Vietnam had allowed our forces to be, our attacking forces to be, choose between shot at by intense anti-aircraft fire or by missiles. MiGs were also there, but they weren't the kind of a problem. And he made it his goal that those enemy forces would be taken out so that attacks could be made with relative impunity. And so he set up, initially they were called Wild Weasels, teams of brave guys of whom we lost a great number, who flew specially armed and equipped F-105s and F-4s, and their task was to go in first, take out enemy radar, enemy surface-to-air missiles, linger there and make sure that they didn't recover until a bomber force had gotten in and gotten out. Well, it went on from there to become a much more developed and much more sophisticated force that we have today, in which you have an array of aircraft, an array of missiles that are dedicated to doing just that task. But it's extremely dangerous and extremely difficult. because the enemy is clever. The enemy doesn't always arm its weapons. You don't know where everyone is. They don't always signal with their radar where they're coming. As in the case of Baghdad, as you recall, we had so flummoxed them with our stealth aircraft that they just stopped using, attempting to use radar to contact, and just simply put up a barrage, hoping that a golden BB would take somebody out. So it's a very, very dangerous and delicate task, but it's essential, and that's one of the first things that has to be done. And it requires attack aircraft. It requires the EF 111 Growler or EF, 17 Growler and the EA-6 Prowler to go in and use their electronic countermeasures to counter the enemy radar. But once that's established, once you've established that you've taken out the enemy air defenses, and then you can put in F-15s and F-16s and other aircraft to take out airfields and command and control centers and so on. But it's an expensive...
And we're talking about a mission that... We're talking about people who flew those missions back in Vietnam who were legends in the air power business. Leo Thorsness, Chuck Horner, giants in the air power field. I mean, these are people who just know what they're practicing and how they're doing it.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. The Leo, of course, was both a Medal of Honor winner and a prisoner of war, and is one of everybody's great heroes. And there would be today if called upon, there are heroes latent in our own Air Force, just like Leo. But the difficulty is you have to have the backing of the country, the backing of the Congress, backing of the administration to decide that you're going to go in and do something, and you're going to do something with full effect. You're not going to do it in a piecemeal fashion. You're not going to do it in a manner that Carter did with this attempt to rescue the hostages in Tehran. You have to go at it full force, and that's what worries me more than anything. I'm not certain that if we attempt to establish a no-fly zone, that we'll do it with the requisite will and with the requisite authority.
And just once you've got it set up, you're really running something that looks a lot like a railroad with airplanes, in the sense that 24/7, 365, you're going to have patrols doing essentially racetracks over Syria, if we go to Syria or anywhere else that we do a no-fly, and they're going to do that until the cows come home or a peace treaty is signed. Correct?
Exactly, and it's boring work, and it detracts from training. The overall combat training of the force is degraded because of that. This is a big problem with Operation Northern Watch and Southern Watch. Is the net effect upon the service is capability is adverse, and yet if you establish it and proclaim you're going to do it, then you have to administer it in just the way you suggest. If you let down for an hour a day, for example, that would be the hour a day they would get all the ammunition that they wanted or all the missiles that they wanted smuggled through. You have to absolutely be totally vigilant to suppress them.
And it's not just the fighters that are up there. It's a whole circus load of everything from AWACS aircraft to ground surveillance, rivet joint aircraft that are going ahead and sniffing the electronic environment and feeding data forward. It's UAVs at high altitude. I mean, you're conducting a large-scale operation, not unlike running a mid-sized regional airport over the top of someone else's car.
Exactly, and then you've got the tankers, but, you know, it goes further back than that because, I hate to keep bringing in the economic side of it, but you're consuming parts and spare parts. You're creating a strain on the logistics system at a time when it's been very much disrupted by the budgetary problems. And so it's the relative resources with which we began previous no-fly zones are not available to the same degree. We still have relatively the power to do it, but we do not have the backup. We do not have any luxury of equipment in the background to undertake this. This comes at a time when, you know, the forces have been used continuously in the Middle East, and there comes at a time when the budget issue has never been so confused. So a no-fly zone will have tremendous political implications for the world and for the Air Force. It will also have tremendous economic implications for the Air Force.
And then there's the wear and tear both on the airplanes, because every hour you fly there is an hour you can't train or use in somewhere else where you really need it. And you're burning up people, too, aren't you?
Yeah, you begin to people get stultified. I mean, it's not the kind of a mission that's exhilarating. You would much prefer to be doing some other kind of a thing, and yet there it is. It's got to be done, and nobody shirks from it. Some people find a faint bit of hope that, okay, you're flying more hours, but you're not putting the strain that you'd be putting on them in combat. And that's probably true. So maybe the net cost on the airframe is not absolute. There might be some mitigating circumstances. But on the guys flying the missions, nothing could be more, not boring, because still it's great flying, and you're flying great airplanes, you're with a great bunch of people. But it's not what you see is the most positive way to spend your time.
It's one of those missions that comes under the heading of sometimes dull, sometimes boring, and, oh, by the way, no matter what you say, you're still flying a high-performance aircraft over an armed enemy, which means it can be dangerous, obviously.
Exactly. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and obviously the living proof of that is a young Air Force captain back in the mid-90s by the name of Scott O'Grady, who found out the hard way that no-flies can get to be a interesting way to spend a week on the ground.
Exactly right. And there's, you know, you're not immune, even if they don't fire at you, you're not immune just to the routine kind of a hazard. It's an endemic in a 30-year-old fleet of aircraft.
Yeah, and it's worth noting the individual we spoke of, Scott O'Grady, was flying a mission over Bosnia-Herzegovina when he was popped by a very talented surface-to-air missile battery commander who was technically known as a sniper operator. And we wound up having to go ahead and put 100 Marines and a number of aircraft off of the USS Kearsarge in harm's way later in the week to go pick him up out of the middle of that place. So there can be consequences, obviously.
And as you point out, to be prepared for that, you've got to have the combat search and rescue people readily available on standby at all times, ready to go. So the every way you look, it's an expensive operation, and there's also just the fact that when you're conducting something like this, it's an open invitation to somebody else somewhere around the world to try to show a little muscle and try to take advantage of it, try to see if your resources are great enough that you can handle this emergency and another one, too. So it's you're on the spot when you get involved in something like this, particularly if you don't have a clear exit point.
Because it's committing a certain percentage of your force, and you really don't have a lot of flexibility to move that piece around anymore.
No, the aerial expeditionary force, the air expeditionary force that the Air Force went to, was designed, to overcome that. But in fact, it's proved that even with that amount of clever management, there's still within that you have almost impossible problems of problems of rotation, problems of getting people to their right assignments without completely disrupting their career. It's fraught with difficulties for the personnel involved.
And as we discussed a little bit earlier, this particular no-fly zone, if established, would have some interesting complications. Most of them Russian in nature, and it needs to be said that the Russian Republic is very supportive of the Syrian regime and has invested a serious amount of manpower and treasure in helping prop them up against the FSA rebels, correct?
Yes, and promising to do more. It's for them, it's besides their long history of support. They have a vested interest in maintaining their Mediterranean presence, and that's really based on a Syrian port. So we have President Putin's open defiance of the United States, if you will, and saying that he will not permit a no-fly zone. So the political implications are very, very serious, and you're guaranteed not to have a UN approval of it because Russia would obviously veto it.
Yeah, they'd use their Security Council veto probably along with China to go ahead and just say,
sure,
no, we don't, the UN does not support this action.
Right. And it's difficult, too, because we'd be based in another, many of our forces would be based in other Muslim countries, particularly Jordan, and you never know what the political climate there is. Everything is so fragile in the Middle East at the present time, and you don't know what the implications are of us conducting a combat operation against a Muslim regime, however, reprehensible it is, how that will be interpreted by other Muslim populations.
And as you say, we would need basing in places like Turkey, Jordan, possibly even Cyprus or Crete to be able to credibly maintain this.
Right. Jordan seems to be the way I think that they will go. I think they will go with bases in Jordan and a one border strip of a no-fly zone designed to protect the refugees. And I think probably Syria would accept that because that would not interfere, the Assad Syria would accept that because that would not sensibly interfere with the flow of munitions that they're going to get anyway. But so it's very difficult to see how a choice will be made to do exactly the right thing unless we do it with full military effort. I hate to see us get in a toe-in-the-water situation. If we're going to go in, we ought to go in and do it well. And I'm not confident that that'll be the case.
So no camel noses in the tent allowed, hopefully.
Exactly.
Now, another Russian complication is that the Russians have given our Syrian friends, for lack of a better term, some very advanced hardware that we've never faced on a battlefield ever before. And one of these is a missile system called S-300, known in NATO parlance as either SA-10 or SA-20. And these are very, very advanced surface-to-air missiles compared to the telephone poles you used to deal with in the SA-2 family when you were flying.
Right. They're well developed. They're not a brand new event on the scene, but they've just been completely upgraded over the years so that they're now extremely formidable. I've seen statements to the effect that the only airplanes that the U.S. would have with effective countermeasures would be the F-22. I don't believe that to be the case, but it is obvious that they are an entirely new factor. I'm not certain that they have them. From what I've seen, they could be en route. They could be on contract. I have not seen, and correct me where I'm wrong, that they are in place.
I've seen a wide variety of reports ranging from, as you say, they're inbound and could be just flown in off of big Antonov transports if they wanted to and just hand them over, or there may be something between 2 and 4 batteries already on the ground. Again, reports are not exactly lucid and consistent on this matter.
No, and because they're mobile, they're much more difficult to track. If they were like Patriot batteries, for example, and we could determine exactly where they were, then you could probably take them out with a Tomahawk. Being mobile, they'll be much more difficult to deal with. Here's where the terrible importance of the time factor is. We've already wasted an enormous amount of time coming to a decision that we will or will not have a no-fly zone. The actions necessary to undertake it will take X amount of time. The longer we wait, the bigger the chances are that those missiles will be effective, and that'll make the task just that much more difficult.
And in addition, also politically that much more dangerous because we probably would have to use that term we were using earlier, kinetic methods to eliminate them. In other words, we could not leave them there and justify sending our crews out as sitting ducks for these things.
No, they would have to be taken out. You couldn't. The last thing that should happen to this country is to have our forces shot down in big numbers. There was a theory of air battle that was proposed in a few years ago that everybody liked, and it was that we shoot down everybody, nobody shoots down any of us, and that's the kind of fight that we should have. If they get an established 10, say, batteries of the F-300s in there, it'd be difficult perhaps to accomplish that. So time is of the essence, and yet I am not confident that this administration in particular is willing to make the kind of rapid-fire decisions necessary to have it good underway.
And this is just one of a number of systems that we are told that the Syrians are being supplied with, ranging from very advanced MAD pads, like the these are manned portable air defense systems like the SA-24, to advanced anti-ship and land attack cruise missiles like the Yakut series, which could theoretically go and attack warships standing offshore between Lebanon and Cyprus. I mean, this is not a single threat.
That's right, and that has been in the back of my mind for so long that that's the most appalling way that they could inflict harm on us, the most damage to our prestige, the most irrevocable kind of thing. If they wouldn't even have to sink the Eisenhower, but just to damage it, to put it out of action with a cruise missile. And you might say, well, the Syrians aren't capable of that, but you don't know that a Russian team might not come in and be capable of it. I fear we have as much to lose in the littoral navy as we do to gain with air power. I'm very, very wary about the possibilities of what could happen in that direction.
One only need remember during the war between Israel and Hezbollah a couple years ago, the Israelis didn't think that Hezbollah had a way to go and hit their ships, and of course they wound up getting dinged with a Chinese supplied cruise missile off of a shore battery run by Hezbollah. I mean, the proliferation of advanced weaponry over there is difficult, even if you've got a scorecard.
And then the subsequent proliferation. Suppose we oppose the no-fly zone, that we get some kind of a agreement between the rebel forces and the Assad government, or however that would work out. No one has any idea of what the weaponry will then be used for by the members of the rebel forces, because they're so disparate, and there are so many elements of it. Many of them as more hostile to the United States than they are to Assad.
And last but not least, and this is for people old enough, like Walt and I, to remember a little thing called the Cold War, there's the big problem, which is rule number one of the Cold War, which is Americans don't kill Russians, Russians don't kill Americans, we hire other people to kill Russians, they hire other people to kill Americans. In other words, you don't allow direct confrontations between us and the Russians, and yet there's a very strong possibility that those advanced missile systems we've been talking about are on the ground there. They're going to have a Russian advisor or two on each vehicle, right?
Oh, I would suspect that the first two sets would have Russian crews, and that all subsequent ones would have Russian advisors, because I'm not in any way denigrating the Syrian people. They are as smart as anybody else. But you don't simply walk to a new weapon system like that and begin operating it overnight. You have to have instruction in it, and the only people to provide it are the Russians. So it's fraught with political implications, as you indicate.
Yeah, and let's face it, that's how we do business around the world. If we send a Patriot battery over to Jordan, for example, there's going to be American technicians and military personnel and instructors to help get their personnel up to speed on using the system. It's just an inevitable consequence that if you start bombing those brand new and advanced systems, you're probably going to kill some Russians.
I can't imagine that you would not, and I'm sorry for any individuals, but I also feel that there's no alternative to taking them out. If you allow them to be established, then you have to talk about something else than a no-fly zone for a while.
So, obviously, the idea of establishing a no-fly zone in and over Syria is one that needs to be carefully considered, well-planned, and needs to be, I think, very much explained to the American people what it is we're about to try and do, correct?
Yes, and we've had, General Walsh, General Dempsey have both indicated that it can be done, and I'm taking them at their word. But when they are told to do it, they're going to have the complete backing of the administration, and then you're going to have to see that the necessary materials are routed to them at whatever cost. I mean, you can't just put people on furlough and say we're going to take the excess money from that and fund a no-fly operation. You're going to have to authorize and appropriate the money necessary to do it, and that again even isn't the end of it, because that there's time between doing that and getting the equipment that you need for them. But this if you plan a no-fly zone, you should consider that we're planning a 6-month operation at a minimum.
And it's going to require the coordination of the military, the Congress, the administration, the State Department, and, oh, by the way, inevitably we like to have allies involved, so there's going to be diplomacy out there as well. I mean, this is the thing with a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah, and particularly Syria, has such an array of friends on the other side of such power, and it's so conflicting that the fact that they are actually employing Hezbollah troops against the rebels. I was amazed to see that Egypt, which is Sunni as Syria is, broke relations with Syria. It is so complex, you could never tell which way the Arab combination or the Muslim combination, I should say, is going to fall on this, because there's the interrelationships are just unbelievably difficult.
Indeed. And I think that puts it into perspective in a way that I've not quite heard either Secretary of State Kerry or Senator McCain or any of the other supporters of no-fly zones around the world really have thought through. And I really appreciate you going and helping our audience get some understanding of this, Walt, because it's not simple. It's not, it's not a 50-word, 22-second soundbite.
No, and it's once begun, it's not easy to get out of. There's some possible embarrassments that might come about. It's very, very difficult to mount something like this from a money-strapped Defense Department, and I just hope that we can pull it off and that no other major flare-up occurs anywhere else while we're doing it.
Pull it off or have the good sense not to do it, one or the other. So with that discussion behind us, it's time to ask you the question, what are you working on now? What's next for Walt Boyne?
Well, I've at 84, John, my wife has finally persuaded me that I ought to lay off writing books for a while. This last year was the first time in 35 years that I didn't have one do as many as five book deadlines do. And I'm really enjoying taking the time off. I'm still doing, articles and forwards, and I do an enormous amount of pro bono work. I help a lot of people out with their stuff. But I don't have that book deadline on looming over me, and I'm reluctant to re-engage in it. I'm finding that it's not bad to have some time off.
Hallelujah, brother. I mean, I'm doing the same myself right now, working more in the journalism and documentary and game design arenas, and it's nice to get back to your roots and not have someone from New York beating on you all the time.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Do you have any idea of things you want to do in the future? I mean, I guess I've gotten so used to you being out there in the public, being a voice for Air Power, providing the public with some real reachable knowledge about our Air Force, our aviation, our air power. Are there things that we can look forward to in the future?
Well, we just had a tragic instance, John. We had a friend of mine, Anthony Chung, and I and a couple of other people started a new air power journal. It's going to be called Visions of Air Power. And it was going to be a journal, not like the very excellent historical journals out there, but this is going to be an avid advocate for the re-exercise of true air power, if you will, politically incorrect air power with some punch. And we have perhaps a half a dozen great articles lined up, including some from Dave Deptul and others. And poor Anthony passed away. So that.
Oh,
I don't
know.
Yeah,
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, it's sort of vitiated the movement. I don't think it'll happen now because he was going to be the publisher on it. But the idea was there that there's nobody who is speaking out now that isn't speaking in politically correct terms. If you'd asked me the five worst words in the English language, I would say politically correct and no collateral damage. I think they've done no more harm to the United States than anything imaginable. And we were not going to be either of those.
Yeah, I'd add rules of engagement to that one, too.
Yeah, that's another two would be good. So we got some words to fix things up.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you do get that thing running, give me a call. I'm happy to contribute.
All right. Well, I'll put you down for that, John. It may revive. I'm working at it at a sort of a it's a little bit delicate because of the family situation there. I don't know his survivors and heirs, so I'm at a loss of it right now in dealing with the situation. But if we can revive it, we will, and certainly call on you.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate you coming on today, Walt. It's good to have a voice that people can actually understand to discuss these rather complex issues, because you're just not going to hear what we've been talking about for the last hour on the evening news. Your final thoughts in summing up?
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. I think that you were able to structure my sometimes long-winded replies in a way that made them more understandable, and I hope it was some service. And if anybody ever has any questions, why, give me a call, and I'd be happy to talk to anybody.
Thank you so much, Walt. We'll be talking again soon, okay?
All right, John. Thank you.
Take care, and my best to your wife. Thank her for giving up her swim time today.
Yep, I've got to go make some amends there. Right.
Take care, sir.
Bye-bye.
And that is our show for this week, Military Monday listeners. I think that we've gone and explored quite a bit about no-fly zones. I invite you to please explore on your own. There's a lot of good information out there if you take the time to look. And if you have any questions about it, please feel free to go ahead and write me. I can be reached at GreshamJ01, GreshamJ01 at yahoo.com if you care to go and ask me some questions. I can also be reached on Facebook and Twitter. And with that, we're going to close up this week for Military Monday. Have a great week ahead. Keep your eyes open, folks. It's going to be a bumpy ride this week. And I'll be back next week at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of Military Monday. Be well.